GXC Founding Underwriting Support is provided by High and Mighty Therapeutic Horseback Riding Therapeutic Drive. Get Driver. Serving children and adults with special needs. For more information, applications, or to volunteer, call 518-672-4202 or online.
Hi, this is Mark Ruffalo, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
We want to know what you think. WGXC invites listeners to share their ideas, input, feedback, praise, and critiques. Email feedback at wgxc.org or drop a note at our Hudson studio at 704 Columbia Street, second floor.
Good morning once again to Grace Notes, the program in which we investigate from novelists and musicians, from philosophers and well-schooled sages, from illiterate laypeople and beloved poets, from scripture and holy books, from spiritual texts and channel tomes, the pathways to our higher selves. I ask you to just let the words and the music and the poetry wash over you, and if any of it resonates, let it sit in your heart and work its way into your core.
And the shrill girls giggle and master around him and squeal as they clutch and thrash, and he blubbers away downhill with his patch pants falling, and his tear splashed blush burns all the way as the triumphant bird-like sisters scream with buttons in their claws, and the bully brothers hoot after him his little nickname and his mother's shame and his father's wickedness with the loose, wild, barefoot women of the hovels of the hills. It all means nothing at all, and howling for his milky mum, for her cowl and buttermilk and cow breath and Welsh cakes and the fat birth-smelling bed and moonlit kitchen of her arms, he'll never forget as he paddles blind home through the weeping end of the world. Then his tormentors tussle and run to the Cockle Street sweet shops, their pennies sticky as honey, to buy from Miss Mavanui Price, who is cocky and neat as a puff-bosomed robin, and her small round buttocks tight as ticks, gobstoppers big as wens that rainbows you suck, brandy balls, wine gums, hundreds and thousands, licorice sweet as sick, nugget to tug and ribbon out like another red rubbery tongue, gum to glue in girls' curls, crimson cough drops to spit blood, ice cream cornets, dandelion and burdock, raspberry and cherry, aid, pop goes the weasel and the wind. Gossamer binen, high heels out of school. The sun hums down through the cotton flowers of her dress into the bell of her heart and buzzes in the honey there and couches and kisses, lazy, loving and boozed in her red-berried breast. Eyes run from the trees and windows of the street, steaming gossamer, and strip her to the nipples and the bees. She blazes naked past the sailor's arms, the only woman on the dye-adamed earth. Sinbad sailors places on her thighs, still dew-damp from the first man-growing cockcrow garden, his reverent goat-bearded hands.
I don't care if he is common,
she whispers to her salad-day deep self.
I want to gobble him up. I don't care if he does drop his H's,
she tells the stripped and mother of the world, big-beamed and eve-hipped spring of herself.
So long as he's all cucumber and hooves.
Sinbad sailors watches her go by, demure and proud and schoolmarm, in her crisp flower dress and sun-defying hat, with never a look or lilt or wriggle, the butcher's unmelting ice-maiden daughter, veiled forever from the hungry hug of his eyes.
Oh, gossamer binen, why are you so proud?
He grieves to his Guinness.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful gossamer bee, I wish that you were for me. I wish you were not so educated.
She feels his goat beard tickle her in the middle of the world like a tuft of wiry fire, and she turns in a terror of delight away from his whips and whiskery conflagration and sits down in the kitchen to a plate heaped high with chips and the kidneys of lambs. In the blind, drawn, dark dining room of schoolhouse, dusty and echoing as a dining room in a vault, Mr. and Mrs. Pugh, are silent over cold, grey cottage pie. Mr. Pugh reads as he forks the shroud meat in from Lives of the Great Poisoners. He has bound a plain brown paper cover round the book. Slyly, between slow mouthfuls, he side-spies up at Mrs. Pugh, poisons her with his eye, then goes on reading. He underlines certain passages and smiles in secret.
Persons with manners do not read at table,
says Mrs. Pugh. She swallows a digestive tablet as big as a horse pill, washing it down with clouded pea soup water.
Some persons were brought up in pigsties.
Pigs don't read at table, dear.
Bitterly she flicks dust from the broken cruet. It settles on the pie in a thin, gnat rain.
Pigs can't read, my dear.
I know one who can.
Alone in the hissing laboratory of his wishes, Mr. Pugh minces among bad vats and jeroboams, tiptoes through spinneys of murdering herbs, agony dancing in his crucibles, and mixes, especially for Mrs. Pugh, a venomous porridge unknown to toxicologists, which will scald and viper through her until her ears fall off like figs, her toes grow big and black as balloons, and steam comes screaming out of her navel.
You know best, dear,
says Mr. Pugh, and quick as a flash, he ducks her in rat soup.
What's that book by your trough, Mr. Pugh?
It's a theological work, my dear. Lives of the Great Saints.
Mrs. Pugh smiles. An icicle forms in the cold air of the dining vault.
I saw you talking to a saint this morning. Saint Polygarter. She was martyred again last night. Mrs. Organ Morgan saw her with Mr. Waldo.
And when they saw me, they pretended they were looking for nests,
said Mrs. Organ Morgan to her husband, with her mouth full of fish as a pelican's.
But you don't go nesting in long combinations, I said to myself, like Mr. Waldo was wearing. And your dress nearly over your head like Polly Garter's. Oh, they didn't fool me.
One big bird gulp and the flounder's gone. She licks her lips and goes stabbing again.
And when you think of all those babies she's got, then all I can say is she'd better give up bird nesting, that's all I can say. It isn't the right kind of hobby at all for a woman who can't say no even to midgets. Remember Bob Spit? He wasn't any bigger than a baby and he gave her two. But they're two nice boys, I will say that, Fred Spit and Arthur. Sometimes I like Fred best, and sometimes I like Arthur. Who do you like best, Organ?
Oh, Bach, without any doubt. Bach every time for me.
Organ, Morgan, you haven't been listening to a word I said. It's Organ, Organ, all the time with you.
And she bursts into tears, and in the middle of her salty howling, nimbly spears a small flat fish and pelicans it whole.
And then, Palestrina,
says Organ Morgan. Lord Cutglass, in his kitchen full of time, squats down alone to a dog dish marked Fido of peppery fish scraps and listens to the voices of his 66 clocks, one for each year of his loony age, and watches with love their black and white moony loud-lipped faces talking the earth away. Slow clocks, quick clocks, pendulumed heart knocks, china, alarm, grandfather, cuckoo, clocks shaped like Noah's whirring ark, clocks that bicker in marble ships, clocks in the wombs of glass women, hourglass chimers, to-wit-to-woo clocks, clocks that pluck tunes, Vesuvius clocks, all black bells and lava, Niagara clocks that cataract their ticks, old-time weeping clocks with ebony beards, clocks with no hands forever drumming out time without ever knowing what time it is. His 66 singers are all set at different hours. Lord Cutglass lives in a house and a life at siege. Any minute or dark day now, the unknown enemy will loot and savage downhill, but they will not catch him napping. 66 different times in his fish-slimy kitchen, ping, strike, tick, chime, and tock. The lust and lilt and lather and emerald breeze and crackle of the bird praise and body of spring with its breasts full of rivering May milk means to that lordly fish-head nibbler nothing but another nearness to the tribes and navies of the last black day who'll sear and pillage down Armageddon Hill to his double-locked, rusty-shuttered tick-tock, dust-scrabbled shack at the bottom of the town that has fallen head over bells in love.
And I'll never have such loving again.
Pretty Polly hums and longs.
Now when farmers' boys on the first fair day come down from the hills to drink and be gay, before the sun sinks, I'll lie there in their arms, for they're good bad boys from the lonely farms. But I always think, as we tumble into bed, of little Willie Wee, who is dead, dead.
We join spokes together in a wheel, but it is the center hole that makes the wagon move. We shape clay into a pot, but it is the emptiness inside that holds whatever we want. We hammer wood for a house, but it is the inner space that makes it livable. We work with being, but non-being is what we use. That's chapter 11 from the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. I'd like now to read from He, Understanding Masculine Psychology, by Robert A. Johnson. This is called Stages of Evolution. According to tradition, there are potentially three stages of psychological development for a man. The archetypal pattern is that one goes from the unconscious perfection of childhood to the conscious imperfection of middle life, to conscious perfection of old age. One moves from an innocent wholeness in which the inner and outer world are united to a separation and differentiation between the inner and outer worlds with an accompanying sense of life's duality, and then, at last, to an enlightenment, a conscious reconciliation of the inner and outer in harmonious wholeness. We are witnessing the Fisher King's development from stage one to stage two. One has no right to talk about the last stage until he has accomplished the second. One has no right to talk about the oneness of the universe until he is aware of its separateness and duality. We can do all manner of mental acrobatics and talk of the unity of the world, but we have no chance of functioning truly in this manner until we have succeeded in differentiating the inner and outer worlds. We have to leave the Garden of Eden before we can start the journey to the heavenly Jerusalem. It is ironic that the two are the same place, but the journey must still be made. A man's first step out of the Garden of Eden into the world of duality is his Fisher King wound, the experience of alienation and suffering that ushers him into the beginning of consciousness. The myth tells us that the Fisher King wound is in the thigh. You may remember the biblical story about Jacob wrestling with an angel. He too was wounded in the thigh. A touch of anything transpersonal, an angel or Christ in the guise of flesh, leaves the terrible wound that cries incessantly for redemption. The wound in the thigh means that the man is wounded in his generative ability, in his capacity for relationship. One version of the story has it that the Fisher King was wounded by an arrow that transfixed both testicles. The arrow could not be pushed through, nor could it be withdrawn. Again, the Fisher King is described as being too ill to live, but unable to die. Much of modern literature revolves around the lostness and alienation of the hero. Moreover, we can see this alienation in the countenance of almost everyone we pass in the street. The Fisher King wound is the hallmark of modern men. I doubt if there is a woman in the world who has not had to mutely stand by as she watched a man agonize over his Fisher King aspect. She may be the one who notices, even before the man himself is aware of it, that there is suffering and a haunting sense of an injury and incompleteness within him. A man suffering in this way is often driven to do idiotic things to cure the wound and ease the desperation he feels. Usually he seeks an unconscious solution outside of himself, complaining about his work, his marriage, or his place in the world. The Fisher King is carried about in his litter, groaning, crying in his suffering. There is no respite for him, except when he is fishing. This is to say that the wound, which represents consciousness, is bearable only when the wounded is doing his inner work, proceeding with a task of consciousness which was inadvertently started when the wound in his youth. This close association with fishing will soon play a large part in our story. The Fisher King presides over his court in the Grail Castle, where the Holy Grail, the chalice from the Last Supper, is kept. Mythology teaches us that the king who rules over our innermost court sets the tone and the character for that court, and thus rules our whole life. If the king is well, we are well. If things are right inside, they go well outside. With the wounded Fisher King presiding, however, at the inner court of modern Western men, we can expect much outward suffering and alienation. And so it is. The kingdom is not flourishing, the crops are poor, maidens are bereaved, children are orphaned. This eloquent language expresses how a wounded archetypal underpinning manifests itself in problems of our external life.
Tarpa, tarpa, tarpa.
It's a piece entitled Tape Bin Balam Morajia, which is based on the Kabir poem called My Heart's in Anguish. My heart's in anguish without my love, restless days, sleepless nights, tormented comes the dawn, mind and body toss and turn, on this empty bed my wasted life, eyes weary, the path still empty. My love is cruel, unaware of me. Kabir says, listen, seekers, assuage this pain in my heart. I'm going to continue now with a chapter called The Inner Fool from He by Robert A. Johnson. Every night there is a solemn ceremony in the Grail Castle. The Fisher King is lying on his litter, enduring his suffering, while a procession of profound beauty takes place. A fair maiden brings in the lance which pierced the side of Christ at the crucifixion. Another maiden brings the silver platter which held the bread at the Last Supper. Another maiden brings the grail itself which glows with light from its own inner depth. Each person is given wine from the grail and realizes their deepest wish they voice before they voice that wish. Each person, that is, except the wounded Fisher King, who may not drink from the grail. This surely is the worst deprivation of all, to be barred from the essence of beauty and holiness, when just those qualities are right in front of you, is the cruelest of all suffering. All are served except the Grail King. All are conscious that their very center is deprived because their king cannot partake of the Grail. I remember a time when beauty was denied me in just this manner. Many years ago I was particularly lonely and at odds with the world during a trip to visit my parents for Christmas. My journey back took me through San Francisco, and I stopped at my beloved Grace Cathedral. A performance of Handel's Messiah was scheduled for that evening, so I stayed to hear this inspiring work. A few minutes into the performance, I was so unhappy that I had to leave. It was then that I knew that the pursuit of beauty and happiness was in vain, since I could not partake of the beauty, even though it was immediately at hand. No worse or frightening pain is possible for us than to realize that our capacity for love or beauty or happiness is limited. No further outward effort is possible if our inner capacity is wounded. This is the Fisher King wound. A true myth teaches us the cure for the dilemma which it portrays. The Grail myth makes a profound statement of the nature of our present-day ailment and then prescribes its cure in very strange terms. The court fool, and every good court has its resident fool, had prophesied long ago that the Fisher King would be healed when a wholly innocent fool arrived in the court and asked a specific question. It is a shock to us that a fool should have the answer to our most painful wound, but this solution is well known to tradition. Many legends put our cure in the hands of a fool, or someone most unlikely to carry healing power. The myth is telling us that it is the naive part of a man that will heal him and cure his wound. It suggests that if a man is to be cured, he must find something in himself about the same age and about the same mentality as he was when he was wounded. It also tells this is why the Fisher King cannot heal himself, and why, when he goes fishing, his pain is eased, though not cured. For a man to be truly healed, he must allow something entirely different from himself to enter into his consciousness and change him. He cannot be healed if he remains in the old Fisher King mentality. That is why the young fool part of himself must enter into his life if he is to be cured. In my consulting room, a man barks at me when I prescribe something strange or difficult for him. "What do you think I am, a fool?" And I say, "Well, it would help." This is humbling medicine to accept. A man must consent to look to a foolish, innocent, adolescent part of himself for his cure. The inner fool is the only one who can touch his Fisher King wound.
Thank you. It is King Arthur, and these are my knights of the Round Table. Whose castle is this?
This is the castle of my master, Guido Luamba.
Go and tell your master that we have been charged by God with a sacred quest. If he will give us food and shelter for the night, he can join us in our quest for the Holy Grail.
Well, I'll ask him, but I don't think he'll be very keen. He's already got one, you see?
What?
He said they've already got one.
Are you sure he's got one?
Oh, yes, it's very nice.
I told them we already got one. Well, can we come up and have a look?
Of course not. You are English type, sir.
Well, what are you then?
I'm French. Why do you think I have this outrageous accent, you silly king?
What are you doing in England?
Mind your own business.
If you will not show us the Grail, we shall take your castle by force.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. I'll blow my nose at you, so-called Arthur King. You and all your silly English kniggets.
What a strange person.
Now look here, my good man.
I don't want to talk to you no more, you empty-headed animal food trough whopper. I fart in your general direction. Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries.
Is there someone else up there we can talk to?
No. Now go away or I shall taunt you a second time.
Now, this is your last chance. I've been more than reasonable.
Fetch in a mash.
What?
Fetch in a mash.
If you do not agree to my commands, then I shall...
Right.
George!
God be praised. Almighty God, we thank thee that thou hast vouchsafed to us the most holy.
English kniggets and Monsieur Arthur King, who has the brain of a duck, you know. So, we French fellows out with you a second time.
How dare you profane this place with your prince? I command you, in the name of the Knights of Camelot, to open the doors of this sacred castle to which God himself has guided us.
How you English say, one more time, Max. Unclog my nose in your direction, sons of a window dresser. So you think you could out-clever us French folk with your silly knees bent running about advancing behavior? I'll wave my private parts at your aunties, you cheesy ladder second-hand electric donkey bottom biters.
In the name of the Lord, we demand entrance to this sacred castle.
No chance, English bedwetting types. Burst my pimples at you and call your door-opening request a silly thing, you tiny-brained whoppers of other people's bottoms.
If you do not open this door, we shall take this castle by force. In the name of God and the glory of our... right! That settles it!
Yes! It's had a lot of this time and can't be approaching anymore, or we fire arrows in the tops of your heads and make castanets out of your testicles already!
Walk away! Just ignore them!
No! Remain an illegitimate-faced bugger folk! And if you think you've got a nasty taunting this time, you ain't heard nothing yet, scabby English kniggets!
You who want peace can find it only by complete forgiveness. No learning is acquired by anyone unless he wants to learn it and believes in some way that he needs it. While lack does not exist in the creation of God, it is very apparent in what you have made. It is, in fact, the essential difference between them. Lack implies that you would be better off in a state somehow different from the one you are in. Until the separation, which is the meaning of the fall, nothing was lacking. There were no needs at all. Needs arise only when you deprive yourself. You act according to the particular order of needs you establish. This, in turn, depends on your perception of what you are. A sense of separation from God is the only lack you really need correct. This sense of separation would never have arisen if you had not distorted your perception of truth and had thus perceived yourself as lacking. The idea of order of needs arose because, having made this fundamental error, you had already fragmented yourself into levels with different needs. As you integrate, you become one, and your needs become one accordingly. Unified needs lead to unified action, because this produces a lack of conflict. The idea of orders of need, which follows from the original error that one can be separated from God, requires correction at its own level before the error of perceiving levels at all can be corrected. You cannot behave effectively while you function on different levels. However, while you do, correction must be introduced vertically from the bottom up. This is because you think you live in space, where concepts such as up and down are meaningful. Ultimately, space is as meaningless as time. Both are merely beliefs. The real purpose of this world is to use it to correct your unbelief. You can never control the effects of fear yourself, because you made fear, and you believe in what you made. In attitude, then, though not in content, you resemble your Creator, who has perfect faith in His creations because He created them. Belief produces the acceptance of existence. That is why you can believe what no one else thinks is true. It is true for you because it was made by you. All aspects of fear are untrue because they do not exist at the creative level, and therefore do not exist at all. To whatever extent you are willing to submit your beliefs to this test, to that extent are your perceptions corrected. In sorting out the false from the true, the miracle proceeds along these lines. Perfect love casts out fear. If fear exists, then there is not perfect love. But only perfect love exists. If there is fear, it produces a state that does not exist. Believe this, and you will be free. Only God can establish this solution, and this faith is His gift.
John sitting on a railroad track, something's out of whack. Blues this morning falling down like hail, gonna leave a greasy trail. Gonna travel the world is what I'm gonna do, then come back and see you. All I ever do is struggle and strive. If I don't do anybody any harm, I might make it back home alive. I'm the oldest son of a crazy man. I'm in a cowboy band. Got a pile of sins to pay for, and I ain't got time to hide. I'd walk through a blazing fire, baby, if I knew you was on the other side. why I miss you anymore. And my happiness is over. Winter's gone, the river's on the rise. I loved you then, and ever shall. But there's no one left in town. The world has gone black before my eyes. While the world of research has gone berserk, too much paperwork. Albert's in the graveyard, Frank is raising hell. I'm beginning to believe what the scriptures tell. I'm going where the Southern Cross is the yellow dog. Get away from these demagogues and his bad luck women stick like glue. It's either one or the other, but neither of the two. She say, look out, daddy, don't want you to tear your pants. You could get wrecked in this dance. They say whiskey'll kill you, but I don't think it will. I'm riding with you to the top of the hill. Oh, I miss you, Lady Moore, and my happiness is over. Winter's gone, the river's on the rise. I loved you then, and ever shall. But there's no one left in a town. The world has gone black before my eyes. Don't know why my baby never looks so good before. Don't have to wonder no more. She been cooking all day, gonna take me all night. I can't eat all that stuff in a single bite. Judge is coming in, everybody rise. Lift up your eyes. You can do what you please, you don't need my advice. For you call me any dirty names, you better think twice. Getting light outside, the temperature dropped. I think the rain has stopped. I'm gonna make you come to grips with fate. When I'm through with you, you'll learn to keep your business straight. Oh, I miss you, Nettie Moore, and my happiness is gone. Winter's gone, the river's on the rise. I loved you then, and ever shall. But there's no one left in a town. The world has gone black before my eyes. The bright spark of the steady lights has dimmed my sights. When you're around me, all my grief gives way. A lifetime with you is like some heavenly day. Everything I've ever known to be right has been proven wrong. I'll be drifting along. The woman on my loving, she rules my heart. No knife could ever cut her love apart. Today I'll stand in faith and raise the voice of praise. The sun is strong, I'm standing in the light. I wish to God that it were night. Oh, I miss you, Lady Moore, and my happiness is over. Winter gone, the river's on the rise. I loved you then, and ever shall, but there's no one here. After town, the world has gone black before my eyes.
distorted perceptions produce a dense cover over miracle impulses, making it hard for them to reach your own awareness. The confusion of miracle impulses with physical impulses is a major perceptual distortion. Physical impulses are misdirected miracle impulses. All real pleasure comes from doing God's will. This is because not doing it is a denial of self. Denial of self results in illusions, while correction of error brings release from it. Do not deceive yourself into believing that you can relate in peace to God or to your brothers with anything external. Child of God, you were created to create the good, the beautiful, and the holy. Do not forget this. The love of God for a little while must still be expressed through one body to another, because vision is still so dim. You can use your body best to help and enlarge your perception so that you can achieve real vision, of which the physical eye is incapable. Learning to this is the body's only true usefulness. Fantasy is a distorted form of vision. Fantasies of any kind are distortions because they always involve twisting perception into unreality. Actions that stem from distortions are literally the reactions of those who know not what they do. Fantasy is an attempt to control reality according to false needs. Twist reality in any way and you are perceiving destructively. Fantasies are a means of making false associations and attempting to obtain pleasure from them. But although you can perceive false associations, you can never make them real except to yourself. You believe in what you make. If you offer miracles, you will be equally strong in your belief in them. The strength of your conviction will then sustain the belief of the miracle receiver. Reality is lost through usurpation, which produces tyranny. As long as a single slave remains to walk the earth, your release is not complete. Complete restoration of the sonship is the only goal of the miracle-minded. This is a course in mind training. All learning involves attention and study at some level. Some of the later parts of the course rest too heavily on these earlier sections not to require their careful study. You will also need them for preparation. Without this, you may become much too fearful of what is to come to make constructive use of it. However, as you study these earlier sections, you will begin to see some of the implications that will be amplified later on. A solid foundation is necessary because of the confusion between fear and awe to which I have already referred and which is often made. I have said that awe is inappropriate in connection with the sons of God because you should not experience awe in the presence of your equals. However, it was also emphasized that awe is proper in the presence of your Creator. I have been careful to clarify my role in the atonement without either over or understating it. I am also trying to do the same with yours. I have stressed that awe is not an appropriate reaction to me because of our inherent equality. Some of the later steps in this course, however, involve a more direct approach to God Himself. It would be unwise to start on these steps without careful preparation, or awe will be confused with fear, and the experience will be more traumatic than beatific. Healing is of God in the end. The means are being carefully explained to you. Revelation may occasionally reveal the end to you, but to reach it, the means are needed.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me this morning. Perhaps you'll join me again in 2 weeks.
Always felt like something was gonna happen, and now Got the feeling he was missing out on something. What could it be? The moose tried meditating, searching the internet, looking into a crystal ball, praying to the moose above, and scanning the night sky, but the moose didn't find a thing. One sunny day, the moose was struck with a thought. He needed to take life by the antlers if he was going to find that something missing. In the same instant, he noticed a sailboat at the water's edge, its sail gently flapping in the breeze. The moose was inspired. With his friends looking on, the moose set sail, but what started as a gentle breeze turned into a strong storm, and soon became a raging storm. The moose battled the storm till he could fight no more. In the morning, the moose woke up scared and alone on a deserted island. Normally, this moose would have curled into a ball and cried. But that day, he took a deep breath and got to work. The moose located a source of fresh water, gathered wood, and made a signal fire, built a shelter, climbed for coconuts, learned to spear fish, and met a tortoise named Tuesday. Over the following days and weeks, the moose faced many challenges and thought of home often. But with Tuesday by his side, he made the most of island life. When it was hot, they went swimming. When the waves were big, they surfed. When it was cold, they roasted coconuts by the fire. Life was pretty good. Then, just as the moose was about to pour Tuesday another coconut smoothie one evening, a ship appeared on the horizon. Quickly, they threw more wood on the fire to get the crew's attention. When the ship came to the moose's rescue, the two friends said their goodbyes, promised to write, and made plans to get together over the holidays. The moose had been rescued on day 3 of a 2-week Caribbean cruise. At first, he was nervous about being back at sea. But when the moose finally left his cabin, it didn't take him long to embrace the cruise ship lifestyle. He enjoyed all-day buffets, shuffleboard on the Lido deck, and all-night card games. When the moose finally arrived home, his friends could hardly believe their eyes. The beaver and the bear thought they had lost their friend forever. They gave him a big welcome home hug. And when the once mild-mannered moose said, "Let's go cliff jumping," his friends were overjoyed. And now we have a letter. "Dear Tuesday, I feel like a new moose. I am always doing something fun and exciting. Can't wait for the holidays. I miss you. Have you ever been to Africa? Love, Moose." The end. This book is called The Useful Moose by Fiona Robinson, and it is a truthful, mooseful tale. Some children like cats. Some children like dogs. I like moose. For vacation, my mom and dad took me to Alaska to see some. I looked on mountains. I looked by glaciers. I looked in forests and fields, but there were no moose. So I climbed a tree to get a better view. All I could see was a goose. Perhaps he knew something. "Hey, Mr. Goose," I called. "Where are all the moose?" "You won't find any here," he said. "The moose have gone on vacation. Usually they go to the beach, but this year they wanted to try something new, so they went off to the city." Well, we didn't wait around. We went home right away. And Mr. Goose was right. The moose were in the city. Our city. Hundreds and thousands of moose. And they were having a great time. That is, except for 3 young moose. I introduced myself. "Hi, I'm Molly," I said. "Is something wrong?" They answered, "Our hooves are aching. They really hurt. And we're so tired. We need a place to rest." Well, how could we refuse such nice young moose? We took them home right away. We had some trouble getting them through the door. It was like moving a piano, except a piano wouldn't complain so much. Then they were so tired they fell asleep at once. That night I went into their room to read them a book. I whispered their names. Monty, Monroe, Milligan. But all they did was snore. They slept and slept, and after 8 days they leaped out of bed and stretched their long legs. "Now, thank you, kind people, for helping us," they said. "Now we want to help you. Please pass us those brushes and brooms." They swept the floor, looking like skaters with the brooms as their partners. It was a superb performance. "You could eat dinner off that floor," said my dad. The moose looked shocked. "It's just a saying," said Mom. "Kitchen next," they shouted as they dashed off. By the time we got there, they had already finished cleaning. Mom and Dad were so impressed. "If you help out around the house," said Mom, "you can stay as long as you want for free." The moose liked this idea. They had always wanted to see humans in their natural habitat, and it wasn't long before they showed us more of their amazing skills. Monty was a great cook. Monroe was a fantastic washer-upper. Milligan and Monty were terrific at drying laundry. And Monroe was wonderful at winding wool. They were three exceptional moose. But it wasn't all work for our guests. We took them out for special treats. They liked movies most. We were all very happy until one day. We were watching a TV show about Alaska when suddenly our moose leaped up. "There's Mom and Dad!" they shouted. And you could see the family resemblance. Then they started to cry. I tried my best to cheer them up, but I knew how they felt. I was homesick once on a sleepover. They bent their heads together and had a quick discussion. "It's the call of the wild, Molly," they cried. "We really must return. We're going to go now before we're cut off by snow. We think a plane takes off at 3. And then they were gone. I missed them so much. It was useless being mooseless. Then one day a postcard arrived. "Molly, nice to be home, but we miss you. We'll try to write often, but soon mailbox will be covered in snow. Lots of love, Monty, Monroe, and Milligan." Months more went by. They called. Just as they were telling my dad how to remove a stubborn coffee stain, the line went quiet. "They're probably caught in a blizzard," said my mom. Nearly a whole year had passed when I sent them an invitation to my birthday party. But they didn't reply. Had they forgotten me? It was the day of my party, and my friends and I were sitting in the yard. Just as everyone started to sing happy birthday, I heard buzzing like the sound of a great big bumblebee. I looked up, blinked, and looked again. "Mom! Dad!" I yelled. "The moose are coming! They've just jumped out of a plane!" Before we could clear the yard of sharp objects, they had arrived. Monty landed in the rose bushes. "Ouch!" he said. Monroe landed in the sandbox. "Perfect," he said. Milligan landed in the ice cream. "Strawberry," he said. They picked themselves up and dusted themselves off. "Surprise!" they cried, grinning from antler to antler. They hadn't forgotten me at all. "And now that we know how to parachute," they said excitedly, "we can drop in any time." Well, some children may like cats. Some children may like dogs. But me? I love moose. The end. This book is called If You Give a Moose a Muffin by Laura Joff Numeroff. If you give a moose a muffin, he'll want some jam to go with it. So you'll bring out some of your mother's homemade blackberry jam. When he's finished eating the muffin, he'll want another. And another. And another. When they're all gone, he'll ask you to make more. You'll have to go to the store to get some muffin mix. He'll want to go with you. When he opens the door and feels how chilly it is, he'll ask to borrow a sweater. When he puts the sweater on, he'll notice one of the buttons is loose. He'll ask for a needle and thread. He'll start sewing. The button will remind him of the puppets his grandma used to make. So he'll ask for some old socks. He'll make sock puppets. When they're done, he'll want to put on a puppet show. He'll need some cardboard and paints. Then he'll ask you to help make the scenery. With the scenery finished, he'll get behind the couch, but his antlers will stick out, so he'll ask for something to cover them up. You'll bring him a sheet from your bed. When he sees the sheet, he'll remember he wants to be a ghost for Halloween. He'll try it on and shout, "Boo!" It'll scare him so much he'll knock over the paints. So he'll use the sheet to clean up the mess. Then he'll ask for some soap to wash it out. He'll probably want to hang the sheet up to dry. He'll go outside to put it on the clothesline. When he's out in the yard, he'll see your mother's blackberry bushes. Seeing the blackberries will remind him of her jam. He'll probably ask you for some. And chances are, if you give him the jam, he'll want a muffin to go with it. The end. Isn't that funny how sidetracked the moose got? Whew! You know what else is funny? Jokes about moose. What do you get when you cross a mouse and a moose? You get Mickey Moose. Is there a mouse in the house? No, but there's a moose on the loose. What has antlers and sucks blood? A mosquito. Where do all the old moose go? To the museum. What do you get when you cross a moose and a ghost? A caribou! Knock, knock. Moose. Moose, you be so nosy. Are you nosy?